It's 6 past the hour on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Yes, good morning, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians of all sorts. Good morning to all you socialists, fish people, cat people, dog people, sexually confused people, all of you. Disappointed people after last night's and yesterday's charade where the coronated faux Christian ex-blow monkey puppet of the Cheney regime's neocon death cult once again took the reins of the country. I don't know, Riley. It was pretty despicable. Him surrounded by his legislative pig pack and all those weird pig people and pens in front of him on the mall. It looked like one big Republican pig farm to me.
Well, it wasn't fun for most of Washington, D.C.
Weepy Republican pig farmers. I just can't stand the earnestness and the sort of like, you know, strange self-satisfaction of them like, oh, look, look. Our evil president is back in place, and it's everything as it should be. Very non-colorful, I would say, by and large. Pretty white, wouldn't you say, Riley?
Well, there were a couple. There was a guy from Houston who did a benediction. They had a woman who actually looks like the woman that does a radio show on our sister station,
Wendy
WBL.
Williams.
Yeah, it looks just like Wendy Williams. She sang. Mm. So there were a couple. I was looking for Brian McKnight. Didn't see him. Mm. But I want to say a special good morning. I know they can't hear this, but I want to say a special good morning to the guys who had to clean up the road apples along the inaugural parade. Mm-hmm. Because at one point, you know, I watched a little bit of the parade because there were a couple of musical units I wanted to see. And at one point, the guy comes down the street with, now usually they, you know, they send the machines to clean up the road apples after the parade's done.
Yeah.
Not in this situation. They actually were cleaning up the road apples as the horses went past.
Yeah.
Right? So this huge troop of horses went past, deposited their whatever on the street.
Yeah.
Guys come by, sweeping it up directly into a garbage can. And they got some of the best applause of the day.
That's because they were the only people that people could truly identify with.
They're yeah.
like, we understand that both on a literal level and a metaphorical level. The guy who's sweeping up the poop after the horses, that's pretty much what most people in this country will be doing, you know, after this administration leaves office.
True. I mean, the guy waved to the crowd. But I got to tell you, Bush was, he scared me yesterday.
Because yesterday?
He was so, no. Yesterday, during the run up to the inauguration,
yeah.
you know, because when you watch C-SPAN, you get these close ups
yeah.
without people like talking over everything, and he had this smug look of self satisfaction.
Oh, really, George Bush? Are you sure you're talking about the president of the United States?
Well, I mean, if you contrast that with how he looked when he was told about the 9/11 attacks, you see that the guy has a pretty rubbery face, I guess. But he had this look on his face like, yeah, I pulled this off. And there's nothing anybody's going to do about it. They say in the papers that he hugged his father when he came forward to the... I didn't see it. I saw him shake hands with his old man. Yeah, but,
no.
You know, they seem to be, you know, kind of fudging. The other interesting thing, Mark, is that there were several comments I heard when I did turn to television with commentary that said there were fewer people along the inaugural line of march than in past recent inaugurations.
I just want to tell our listeners, you know, we ignored this yesterday. We're not going to spend too long on it today.
No, it's not worth it.
The message is that, you know, if I could sort of extrapolate or parse the message of the speech, is that we're going to fight tyranny with tyranny, and he is God's anointed leader. And that people deserve rights because they are created in God's image, not because they deserve rights, because that is the right thing to do. I just have a tremendous amount of contempt for the pomp and circumstance of the whole thing. I have a tremendous amount of contempt for the arrogance of this administration. And I have a tremendous contempt for the legislative pig pack that surrounds him.
Bringing democracy at the point of a gun. That's the Bush
way. That's right. Guess what? Freedom's here.
Yeah,
we're going to be back with the Morning Seditions Radio Theater. It's 10 past the hour. Good morning. It's Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition.
We are the highest rated, most respected news show in America.
On Air America Radio.
the Morning Sedition Radio Theater Company players bring you their production of The Shadow Government.
Deep in Washington, D.C., lives a group that has the ability to cloud citizens' minds. What evil lurks in the heart of the shadow government? Mark Maron knows. When we last left our hero, his search for Colin Powell had led to Washington, D.C., where Bill Clinton said something big was going down.
Something big's going down. Can I leave? I don't have any more lines.
By the time I got to D.C., my head was pounding like an oil derrick in the Alaskan wilderness, and I was coming up just as dry. I was trying to remember what Clinton told me back in New York, but my memory had drowned in a tsunami of Johnny Walker Black. All around me were white people dressed like Mr. Moneybags in the Monopoly game. They looked a lot like Republicans. I stood out like Janet Jackson at a Ku Klux Klan cotillion.
Four more years!
Hey, you mugs, what's the skinny? Where's the shindig? What's with the hoopla? I couldn't figure out what they were saying. I needed a little hair of the dog to wash away the cobwebs. So I steered myself toward a bar. But the bouncer there was as friendly as Rumsfeld at a press conference and about as helpful.
Hey, bub, this is a party for GOP senators, sponsored by General Electric. If you ain't a senator, tickets are 100,000 simoleons.
Hey, pal, I just want to ask some of the swells at the party if they know where to find Colin Powell.
And I want a date with Angelina Jolie. Everybody's got a dream.
He tossed me to the curb just as a brand new unmarked sedan pulled up. A half dozen clowns jumped out, and not the funny kind. These were the kind who wear black suits and earpieces and like to attach wires to guys like me. From the look of the heaters they were pulling, they were getting ready to fill me with more holes than the Warren Commission report. I beat it through the crowd with the gorillas hot on my tail.
Money trickles down from the wealthy.
The election in Iraq doesn't have to be successful in order to be a success.
Everyone should have a right to own a gun. Okay, everyone but that guy.
I gave them the slip by ducking into a desolate alley, a second home to the outcasts and badasses of society. That's when I heard a familiar voice.
Hey, you want a taste? I wiped it off.
It was Kid Rock, offering up a half-empty fifth of Southern Comfort. It figured he'd be drawn to this scene. The town was overrun with white trash, Republicans, and heavy drinking. It was a Kid Rock trifecta. Hey, Kid, doing a show in town?
Aw, my gig got canceled because I did a song about pimping Barbara Bush. That's a compliment where I come from. Now everyone in town is down on the Kid. Even Colin Powell dissed me for ripping off black music. Ain't that a bitch?
Where do you see Powell?
At the studio where I'm shooting my new video. He told me not to tell anyone I saw him. So, I gotta get on that real soon. You know, not telling anyone.
I softened him up by saying he should have gotten a Golden Globe for his performance in Joe Dirt. He offered to show me the studio where he'd seen Powell.
Last time I saw him, he was down here in the basement going through these boxes of videotapes.
I picked up a tape labeled Panic Project and popped it into the machine. I couldn't believe it. There was Bin Laden himself, just like the tapes I'd seen on the internet. In this one, he was threatening the country.
I do not hate America. I merely wish to erase it like a stain from the earth.
And there were hundreds of other tapes. They were all labeled OBL. One had Bin Laden threatening Europe.
I dislike polkas intensely. Poland must pay.
One of them seemed to be for a dating service.
I like walks on the beach, sunsets, and subservience to jihad. I'm not fussy. But please, no smokers or fat chicks.
And one tape looked like an audition reel for The Tonight Show.
Am I the only one who hates airline food? Are you with me, people?
Two things just didn't add up. First of all, Bin Laden's material was really hacky. And B, it looked like he had taped all the videos right here at this studio. He had been in Washington, D.C. all along. Kid, we gotta get out of here.
Cool. Let's head to the Lincoln Memorial. The Bush twins are gonna pose for the Girls Gone Wild cameras.
Suddenly, the lights went out.
What the?
Someone had entered the basement and they weren't alone. I froze in place, back to back with Kid Rock and ready for... Well, I wasn't sure. Just then a match flared, lighting up the face of the man in front of me. Holy Masonic conspiracy. It was him.
Who is this mysterious figure? What happened to Colin Powell? Can Mark ever get the image of Kid Rock pimping Barbara Bush out of his head? Find out next week when Kid Rock says...
Dude, Barbara and Jenna are giving Lincoln Statue a lap dance.
That's next time on The Shadow Government. And tune in later for Morning Sedition Radio Theater's production of The Lone Ranger.
Which way did they go, Tonto?
Why do I have to play Tonto? Just because I'm black? Is that supposed to be close to Indian or something?
What did you say, Tonto?
This is the last time. They went that away, Kemosabe.
I owe silver! Away!
Kemosabe, my ass. I'll hire you, you cracker. I'm coming back here with Al Sharpton and my union rep. Let's see how liberal everybody feels about that.
That's The Lone Ranger. Later on Morning Sedition's Radio Theater.
We're back. We're back. It's Morning Sedition, 20 past the hour. Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Yo!
It's the day after the nightmare of confirmation. It's the day after, you know, the legislative pig pack of the neocon death cult takes control once again. The Cheney regime's neocon death cult zombie brigades were there. The Christo-fascist zombie brigades
but
were
you know
rejoicing.
What? They didn't take full control. You know why?
Because they held up Condi Rice.
There you go.
That's what we can do. We can stop someone. We're going to make them wait.
Hold up. Wait a minute. That's
exactly.
Right.
And you were telling me that you think Colin Powell was a little pissed off, huh?
Well, they say that Colin Powell was really planning on getting out of Dodge yesterday. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, when Rice was sworn in, he's done. Now that they're going to push back the debate till Tuesday and the floor vote until Wednesday, Colin Powell has to stay on as Secretary of State.
Right, you know, well, yesterday, there's one, a couple other things I want to, you know, finish about this inauguration, which is essentially, one, there was one voice of reason. One voice of reason standing out in the crowd, in the multitudes, a voice of reason rising above the rest. On television, if you were watching CNN, I believe, was it CNN? Yes, it was CNN. The audio, there was something wrong with the audio, and they weren't picking up Wolf Blitzer, but they did pick up the one voice of reason yesterday, and I think we should play this. It took them 20 seconds before they actually corrected this problem. Can we hear that?
Tell us what's going on.
Well, we faced off with police who are trained on several hundred probably close to the of all those who are the police going past. So what you have is a face off, but it's pretty much a polite day just a moment ago. For whatever reason, the crowd has been held out in
All right, Bob, I'm going to interrupt you. We're having a little trouble hearing you. It's very noisy where you are.
It would have been great if Wolf would have said, yeah, we're going to interrupt him, and then, but we're going to try and fix this, and went right back to the guy saying F. Bush.
Yeah, yeah, that wasn't George we were bleeping.
That was, you know, that went out on the wire on CNN, and it did. It went uninterrupted. You know, no Michael Powell in sight.
Yeah, right.
Who, you know, who apparently you're saying is he might be taking some time off, right?
He's resigning. The Wall Street Journal says he's going to call it quits as chair of the FCC. I guess he and Colin are going to
hit the road.
Hit the road together.
Yeah.
The Powell family.
Do some singing.
Singing.
Couple
dancing.
Of jokes and bits.
Brian McKnight, you
who
know.
Who the hell
trio.
Knows?
I
who
don't
the
know.
Knows? I'm going to be up here. I'm going to be up in Boston tonight. I'm going to be performing at Jimmy Dingle's Off-Broadway Theater in Davis Square, Somerville, Massachusetts, tonight and tomorrow night. I'm going to take the train out of here. You know, oddly, you know, we were making jokes yesterday about those four Chinese supposed terrorists who came up through Mexico. They had pictures of them. They were making their way to Boston. I'm making jokes. Now, that's going to take a little piece of my audience away, you know, because they're probably heading to my show. And you give me this article this morning. Sometime after the photographs were published, a public transit bus driver notified police that he thought he had dropped off two of those pictured in Somerville,
Bing!
A suburb north of Boston. The Boston Herald reported Thursday, but police descending on a Dunkin' Donuts franchise made no arrests. What is that?
I would stay away from Mr. Dunkin' if I were you.
But
while
you know,
you're up
it's
there.
Somerville. The whole they got all in New England, and I'm going to be in Somerville. What is that?
Coincidence
or
conspiracy?
Or just some bus driver saying, that must be the two Chinese guys there.
Yeah, well, you know, they apparently they've widened the list now. The FBI's got, I think it's like 10 people now they're supposedly looking for.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but the whole question of how factual this particular tip is has not yet been dealt with. Apparently, it caused chaos in Boston yesterday.
So, wait, it did? So, wait, now,
yeah.
You know, great. So do I need to take this personally? Would they go out of their way that far? Would the Bush administration on the eve of the inaugural go that far to sort of plant fake terrorist warnings to sabotage my show at the Jimmy Tingle Theater off Broadway?
Yes. The answer is yes.
Come on.
And we'll be talking to Jimmy later to find out the latest on this.
Yeah, Jimmy's going to say hi on the show. He's got some reflections on the inaugural. And also we've got Borzu Daragahi. He's going to give us the update from Iraq. He's in Iraq. Joseph Heath and Andrew Potter later in the third hour of the show, authors of A Nation of Rebels, Why Counterculture Became Consumer Culture. They're going to discuss the illusion of nonconformity and how the counterculture is perfectly capitalist. You know, I'm almost done with this book. And, you know, it's a mind-blowing book. It's one of those books where it's a real broad spectrum of stuff. They, you know, they attack, they deconstruct Freud, they deconstruct Marx, they deconstruct the entire 60s counterculture. They talk about how dissent and deviance became melded in the cultural eye, thus creating a sort of, you know, outlaw romantic sort of mythology of what it means, like the whole idea of just like, you know, I'm breaking the law, man, I'm changing things, you know, that whole sort of like, you know, Easy Rider. But it's very interesting how they talk about how actually there was a breakdown, like with the actual civil rights movement and all the things that were actually proactive in dissent, in changing legislation that was truly unjust, got sort of melded in the 60s with just the momentum of counterculture. Like there were plenty of people that were just like, drop out, let's get high, tear down the system, that were basically, you know, just getting wasted.
Did they ever meet Ella Baker, either of these guys? I have to ask them this when we have them on. But they ought to have met Ella Baker while she was alive.
I don't know if they ever met Ella Baker. I don't think so. They're Canadians. They're philosophers. They're up there looking at us through their lens.
But when they talk about the civil rights movement, they should know who Ella Baker was.
Well, I'm sure they do. And they weren't in essence talking about the civil rights movement. What they were talking about was that there's a certain mythos in this country that happens certainly in alternative circles and progressive circles where, you know, one thinks just because they think that they're doing something, like just because they're sitting on their couch smoking pot saying screw the president, that they're somehow facilitating change, that they are somehow, you know, an outlaw, progressive renegade, where actually they're not any of those things. They're just some idiot sitting on a couch smoking pot talking to their friends.
Wait a minute, is this like the guys that threw the snowball at the President's Motorcade?
Yeah, well, that was actually a pretty decent act of civil disobedience. A little impotent, unfortunately, but it made it through, and they didn't take the guy out. Hey, there's the dude with the snowball!
Whoa! Ooh, that hurt.
But, you know, it got through. I just wish it was something else.
We got the Ray just left.
Uh-huh.
We got the Palm Pilot coming up. Also, Borzu Daragahi live from Iraq when we return here on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley, Mornings Edition on Air America Radio.
Four past the hour. Good morning. It's Friday. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
You're listening to Air America Radio. How does that feel? How does that feel for you today after the coronation of the Pig King? How does it feel? The neocon death cult's Pig King is back. Yes, that's what it sounded like on the mall. Did you hear the rounds of applause when he started talking about God? That is all you could hear on the whole. It was weird to see it. You wouldn't have known that if you were watching it without sound. But there, all right. Anyways, so here we go. Here is George Bush's from Ramon, who again wearing a Napoleon hat and epaulettes came and delivered us George Bush's Palm Pilot for today. 7 a.m. Wake up, stare in mirror. They put me back in office. Even I don't get this. 9 a.m. breakfast, stack of Texas-sized flapjacks and a half pint of Jim Beam. Note, these days of living for them are over. The days of living for me have just begun. 10 a.m., attend National Prayer Service, Washington National Cathedral. Note, I'm beginning to wonder about this whole prayer thing. Those damn terrorists pray 3-4 times a day. Look where it got them. 1 p.m., find out who hit Cheney's car with a snowball, then hand them over to Gonzalez and his boys as a little inauguration present. 2 p.m., call police department in Rio de Janeiro. Have American ambassador bail out the twins. Note, never take your eyes off those two. 6 p.m., build true bipartisan coalition to help heal this country's deep ideological divisions. Hey, who put this in here? 9 p.m., flop on the couch, drink Jim Beam, and watch a rodeo. Note, I rule the world. Yes, sir. On the phone, one of our favorite journalists there in Baghdad, Borzi Daragahi. He's now working for the Newark Star Ledger, the Boston Globe, and the San Francisco Chronicle, and for us here at Air America Radio. Good morning, Borzi. What's the reaction among the Iraqi people to the latest audio tape of Al-Zarqawi's group?
Well, every time one of these tapes comes out, really people shiver. It's just it's a sign of more bloodshed to come. Just this morning, there was today is a very important Muslim holiday here in the Middle East, and a lot of people were going to the mosque. And this morning, at around I think it was like around 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, and just as people were going to one mosque, there was a car bomb there, killing at least 13 people. So it just makes them cringe and anticipate even more bloodshed.
What did the videotape say? What did Al-Zarqawi say, or whoever his spokesman was? What was it telling the people?
It was a warning to Bush and a warning to the world, really, that this fight is going to drag on. That our their battle, their battle against the West and against their enemies will go on for months and years, and they're ready for the long haul. So it was just a very ominous kind of message, sort of counterbalance to George Bush's message of this sort of long fight for whatever he calls freedom. He was basically saying that we're really not going to give up that easily.
So it's interesting. It seems that in Iraq, not unlike in America, there are people promoting a culture of fear and terrorism in order to alter the vote. How are people going to vote? What's the turnout going to be, do you think?
Well, I'm not going to give a number. I just don't know. I'm not certain about that. But I will say in Iraq's Kurdish north, there'll be a lot of people who are going to enthusiastically go and vote. And in parts of Iraq's Shia south, people are going to vote. Heck, they have to. I mean, their spiritual leader basically ordered them to vote. And he also issued a fatwa or edict saying that if you get killed while you're voting, you'll go to heaven. That was Ayatollah Ali Sistani, the country's highest spiritual leader. What people are very concerned about is the middle of the country, the Sunni Arab, as well as the capital. How many people are going to go out and vote then? Especially if they wake up with the sounds of car bombs everywhere, are you really going to risk your and your family's life to go and cast a ballot in an election that George Bush has already downplayed? I don't know. I doubt a lot of people will vote in those parts of the country.
Maybe they should be saying you might go to heaven if you try to vote.
Borzu, you have a piece in the Star Ledger the other day that talks about the fact that many of the, so-called smaller parties in Iraq are underfunded and really can't contest this election because they have no money to go out and campaign. Are the Iraqi people at all concerned about the parties that do have the money? For example, the party that Prime Minister Alawi represents.
But I think a lot of people, a lot of especially secular people who are really afraid, a lot of secular, non-religious Shias, they're going to vote for Alawi just because they see him as a kind of a sign of stability. They just don't want any more instability, and so they'll vote for Alawi. I think a lot of people are really spooked by his ad campaign here in Iraq. No one's ever seen anything quite like it. He's got these very, very slick, very well-produced one-minute spots that are on there, a lot of feel-good, I feel your pain kind of stuff. He's got an hour-long documentary that's airing on Al Arabiya, which is one of the most popular and expensive satellite networks around here. And everyone's wondering, where's his money coming from? How is he doing this? Who's behind his campaign? And then you've got the Shias that are the Shia list that's out there campaigning quite vociferously. They've got their own TV stations. They don't really need to buy ads. They're spewing 24-hour propaganda, and they've plastered the whole country, it seems, sometimes with their posters, which have pictures of Ali Sistani and urging people, to vote as their religious duty. So everyone's also wondering where they're getting this kind of funding.
So where are they getting the funding, Borzu? Where is Alawi getting the funding?
I'm not certain, but I mean the speculation is that he went to a lot of the Gulf states. The U.S. government, by the way, has promised and they've sworn up and down that we're not giving any money to any candidate.
Yeah.
People suspect that Alawi has gone to the Gulf states, you know, like Saudi Arabia, which owns Al Arabia, and to, you know, Dubai, the Emirates, and Kuwait, and said, look, you don't want a Shia clerical-dominated government in Iraq? You know, cough up some dough.
So they're getting their money from
speculation.
They're getting their money from the same place Bush gets some of his money.
I'm not going to speculate on that.
But okay, here's another question: is this story of Alawi actually being actually killing those six people in that police station at gunpoint? Has that been validated? Is that getting any play? Is he using that in his campaign commercials?
No, I don't think he's using that in his campaign commercials, but I would say that a lot of Iraqi people are so fed up, it would probably help him. They're so fed up with the violence. Probably, like, you know, Alawi, the guy who whacked four guys just like that.
Yeah.
We need for minister at this point.
So how was it? Was there any reaction among Iraqis to Cheney's remarks yesterday that the Bush administration miscalculated and how fast Iraq would recover from the U.S.-led invasion?
Sadly, the electricity situation here is so bad that no one really has a chance to watch that much TV anymore. And they're just not aware of what's going on in the world often, especially on a Friday, because in Fridays in Iraq, newspapers don't come out. So, you know, they didn't get it. Maybe they would have reacted if there was some electricity to watch TV. But
oh,
there isn't.
Boy. So how is it going to work? Who are they going to vote for? What are the choices? I mean, we talked to somebody last week who said that it's not even clear, you know, who the choices are. It's just sort of block parties. I mean, how does it work?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you've got these tickets of candidates, you know, up to 275 candidates per ticket. And if you get a lot of votes, a lot of your, you know, guys will get in there. And the problem is that none of the parties have released the names of the party, of the people in their party on their list. So no one knows who they're really voting for except, like, the top guy on the list. And you can't really blame the parties, you know. I mean, like, you know, you list some guy's name on your you publicize somebody's name who's running, and you might as well be signing his execution warrant with the insurgents out there basically killing anybody who they deem, you know, involved with the election.
Borzu, do you get any sense at all that the Iraqi people, ordinary everyday people, are in any way fed up with the insurgency? We keep hearing about all these Iraqi people dying. When is that going to reach critical mass with people?
Well, I think people are very fed up with the insurgency. What can they do? I mean, a lot of these guys are, I think it's becoming clear that the backbone of the insurgency are Iraq's, you know, Saddam's former IIS people, Iraqi intelligence service people, the sort of, you know, the wizards of Saddam's like black ops wizards. And these guys are just really good, and they know Iraq really well, and they know how to terrorize people really well. And so they're, you know, offering logistical training. I mean, these are the guys who don't do the car bombs. You know,
yeah.
These are the guys who go do the kidnappings. These are the guys who seem to be organizing it. And, you know, the sort of tactics that seem to be emerging are quite clear, the tactics of people who know what they're doing. You know, in terms of using 30 guys to stage a kidnapping, and, you know, none of your guys get killed, but four of their guys get killed.
Interesting.
So they're quite good, you know, commando-style stuff. So I don't know what you can do about them. Of course they're fed up. They're terrified, you know, Iraqi people. But what can they do?
Well, thank you for the grim reality, Borzu. Be careful over there.
Thanks a lot. Anytime.
All right, take care, Borzu.
That's Borzu Daragahi in Baghdad, Iraq. We will be back with Mark Riley's Dog of the Week. It's 44 past the hour on Air America Radio.
Who are these two?
Morning Sedition.
On record is out. It's no secret anymore.
Morning Sedition from Air America Radio.
Cholesterol.
For the 9 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Yeah.
That's right. Join the Morning Sedition Book Club. Purchase Sam Lipsight's Homeland by going to morningsedition.com. Sam will be back in the studio on January 28th to take your calls and discuss the book. Here's a little taste.
Feeling is not quite the word for the feeling.
How's bathing at knife point in the phlegm of the dead?
Oh, how's that sound? I always
feeling is not quite the word for the feeling.
Oh.
How's bathing at knife point in the phlegm of the feeling is not quite the word.
It's stuck, dude. This board is pissing me off this morning. Man, who pushed the loop button?
Uh-oh.
Well, I didn't know there was a loop button.
That was me. Sorry about that.
Wait a minute. What does the loop button do?
It repeats everything.
Wow, wait. Oh, that's great. Here's a little more Sam Lipsight.
We didn't have squash at Eastern Valley. We didn't have tennis either, unless you count that trick with the steel hairbrush and the catgut racket, whereby the butt skin of the weak was flayed.
Uh-oh.
It's a funny book. It's powerful. It's bitter. It's dark. It's hilarious. If you're, you know, an apathetic, crazy, bitter person who wants some validation in this life, buy Sam Lipsight's Homeland and enjoy. Right now it's time for... Mark Riley's Dog of the Week.
Yes, yes, yes. Let's see now. You know, Mark, there were a few candidates for Dog of the Week. There's, of course, G.W. Bush. He was inaugurated yesterday. And for a minute, he looked like he had just sold a car with no brakes to a blind man. Uh-huh. But no, that's a little too obvious. Uh-huh. Our Dog of the Week this week comes from the great state of Ohio. The Buckeye State's Attorney General, James Petro, has filed for censure against the four attorneys who challenged Ohio's election results. The reason? Petro says the quartet filed a frivolous lawsuit in trying to investigate Ohio's allegedly tainted balloting. His filing says, quoting here, contestants offered only theory, conjecture, hypothesis, and invective, end quote. Gee, could that be because the AG's cut buddy, Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell, has refused to release any information refuting those allegations?
Hmm.
That's the same Kenneth Blackwell, by the way, who saw no problem in supervising the election in Ohio while serving as state boss of, you guessed it, the Bush-Cheney campaign. There's a sick symmetry in Petro's filing. He accuses the lawyers of abusing the discovery process, yet he sought and used every trick in the book to deny them the information they sought. In the words of one prominent Ohioan, that's trickeration.
Trickeration.
Hey. It also makes Ohio Attorney General James Petro the morning sedition dog of the week. Now, for those of you who don't know who I was talking about in terms of the prominent Ohioan, uh-oh.
Yeah.
That would be Don King.
Oh, yeah.
Bush supporter.
Okay. That was a good one, Mark.
Thank you.
I forgot. Like, you know, I'm gonna be at Jimmy Tingle's Off Broadway Theater tonight and tomorrow night in Somerville, Massachusetts. On the phone with me now is comedian Jimmy Tingle, who you know he used to be on. I forgot about this too because I was reading over his press stuff. He was on 60 Minutes too for two seasons.
Really?
Uh huh.
Uh-oh.
He was in the Andy Rooney spot. He's appeared on the Tonight Show, Larry King Weekend, The Late Show with Conan O'Brien, The Late Show with Tom Snyder. We're going back a bit. The American Comedy Rewards. as well as his HBO comedy special. Good morning, Jimmy. What's going on?
Good morning, Mark. Good morning, everybody.
Hey, Jimmy.
Mark, you forgot Star Search.
Star Search! Jimmy Tingle, of course, if you remember Star Search.
How can you forget? I got 2.5 stars.
How did you do on that one? Did you how many rounds did you make it?
I lost on my first trip.
To who?
I lost to Evan Davis.
Oh, where's he been? Man, that guy.
Yeah, and he lost to Sinbad in the finals.
Oh, see, and what happened to that guy? It's better off you lost.
Yeah.
That's probably a gift. So what's going on, Jimmy? You watched the inauguration?
Oh, yeah, I watched it yesterday, and it's interesting. You know, when a speech goes well for the president, he takes credit and all his supporters take credit. Of course, when the speech turns out to have some false or misleading information, all his supporters say, hey, give him a break. He didn't write the thing.
Right.
The CIA wrote the speech.
So what else? You were talking about, I read a little bit that you did about how there's a similarity between, you know, how CBS treated Dan Rather's crew.
Well, yeah, yesterday's inauguration could have been an opportune time for the president to take a page out of 60 Minutes and admit he actually made a mistake.
Right.
Because we remember CBS fired one person and asked three others to resign because they failed to live up to their own journalistic standards when they used a forged document in the story about President Bush's National Guard service during the Vietnam War. Now, the report said the producers suffered from, quote, myopic zeal. Now, to their credit, CBS ran an internal investigation, got rid of the people responsible, and apologized to the nation for misleading the public. Now, in an unrelated but interesting twist, just last week, American weapons inspectors officially ended their search for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Now, evidently, ladies and gentlemen, there are none. However, at one point, they thought those trailers they found out in the desert were mobile chemical and nuclear weapon labs. Mm-hmm. And I guess what made the inspector suspicious is that one of the trailers had Nevada plates. Which is a dead giveaway. But seriously, yeah. It seems to be more outrage at CBS and Dan Rather for quoting a forged document.
Maybe forged.
Yeah, accusing young George Bush of not showing up for his National Guard duty during the Vietnam War than there is 30 years later with President George Bush for using false information to start the war in Iraq.
Right.
Talk about myopic zeal.
Yep.
And we all remember Colin Powell addressing the United Nations with those charts and diagrams and those grainy satellite photos supposedly showing chemical weapons factories in Iraq and the vehicles used to transport the weapons of mass destruction. And I remember looking at those satellite photos and saying to myself, gee, I guess it's Iraq, but honestly, it looks a lot like Massachusetts.
We got to go, Jimmy.
Okay.
Hey, man, I'll see you tonight at the show.
Thanks a million, Mark. It's going to be a pleasure having you, man. Thanks for having me on, you guys.
Great to talk to you. Take care, Jimmy. That's funny.
We didn't get to ask him about the whole Chinese scare thing. Are you going to do if there are 10 guys in your audience, 10 Chinese guys sitting in the front row?
Whatever they want. We got to play that down. Come on out. Here's a liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. One, start referring to yourself as a mistreated veteran of the inauguration. Two, post-inauguration protest meeting. Review video of yesterday's events and brainstorm how you can make future protests even more smug and ineffective. Three, Obama and SpongeBob in 2008. Just think about it. Four, push for shorter tours of duty for Iraq war protesters. Those poor people are out there without any protection. Five, phrase of the day, just drop it into conversation. Reagan had Iran-Contra, Clinton had Monica Gate, Nixon had to resign. Enjoy your second term, a-hole. Wake up, sheeple. It's the beginning of the end. What do we got coming up, man?
Are you ready, kids?
Yes.
Aye, aye, Captain.
Oh, SpongeBob, we're going to go.
I can't hear you.
Is SpongeBob gay?
Is he gay?
I don't know.
We'll find out in the next hour of Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio.
Listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Having
was that deterred? Is Are you talking about Kate Hudson again?
No.
Sorry.
No, I'm not. I'm not going to go there. She's, you know, whatever. You know what she is.
She's your girl. She's your homie. She's all right with you. By the way,
I
found the greatest quote from the Bush inaugural.
What do you got?
The best quote.
Yes.
This is our president.
Mm-hmm.
Self-government relies, in the end, on the governing of the self.
No, he did not say that.
Yes, he did.
What does that even mean?
It doesn't mean anything. That's the whole point. None of it meant anything.
Is that in the text of the speech?
Yes.
Self-government relies on the governing...
In the end, the governing of the self.
What does that even mean?
I guess it means that if you want to be self-governing, you have to do it yourself.
It means like, hey, when it comes right down to it, you're on your own, suckers. Good luck. Good luck. And then, of course, the applause from the crowd. Hey, self-governing.
Feed him to the pigs.
You know, it's weird that, you know, as he slowly sells out all the delusional, narrow-minded religious people that voted him in, and he will.
Yes, he will.
And they'll just look at it as like, well, he's got his ways. You know, this is just a message from God. The reason that our chosen king did not, you know, put through any of the policy he promised, that doesn't matter. God's got his ways.
He didn't promise anything. That's the amazing thing. The man offered no details about anything.
Backed off the gay marriage amendment.
Yeah, backed off. He'll go back on it again if the wind blows that way. That's the way this guy governs. That's the way the entire cabal governs.
It's good.
By the way, you know, I noticed something about Dick Cheney during the inauguration parade, too.
It's good that he backed off on some level.
On some level, but he's not going to stay backed off.
On all levels. You know what? to hell with those people. That's it. You know what I mean? That's where they're all going. They think they're not, but that's exactly where they're going. They don't know enough to know that that's where they're all going. They're going to hell. We're not the ones going to hell, Riley. You know
I know.
Because in order to go to hell, you have to believe it exists. All right? So... and on a few levels, I just really wonder, you know, when it comes right down to it, what these people are going to say about this guy. All he's dead set on doing is breaking them. That's all he's dead set on doing is that, okay, if you're going to vote over your self-interest, you know, over your self-interest on moral principles that you think I'm going to put through for you, all he's going to do is continue to screw those people.
That's why he looks so smug and self-satisfied. Just.
Yeah, why wouldn't he? He's sacrificing the ideological extremes of his base.
It looks like he just fleeced about 25 or 30 people playing three-card Monty right over here in Times Square. That's how he looked yesterday.
He certainly did. And then the one guy, the one voice of reason. Chris, do we have that? Can you pull that up in the meantime of the CNN thing? The one voice of reason that could be heard on CNN Live saying, you know, with clarity, what needed to be said yesterday, because there was some audio problem on CNN. Thank God it got on for about 20 seconds. Let's hear that, Chris.
Tell us what's going on.
Well, we've made up with police who are several hundred probably killed from say nothing of all those who are the police doing that. So what you have is a face off, but it's pretty much a polite thing that you were hearing just a moment ago. It seems that for whatever reason the crowd has been held out in
all right, Bob, I'm going to interrupt. We're having a little trouble hearing you. It's very noisy where you are.
And I'm surprised we didn't hear.
Yeah, right.
Silenced. One snowball made it through. One voice of reason made it onto the air. And one snowball made it through to the limo of neocon death cult supreme commander, Vice President Dick Cheney. And
Dick Cheney spent the entire inauguration leaned over the podium that they had with the reviewing stand with his fingers extended like in this whole claw looking thing.
Yeah.
Through the entire time I saw him during.
He got kind of hung up with these hands saying he thought it implied something.
Yeah, I thought it implied there was something wrong. I'm not sure what it was. I'm not sure whether, you know, maybe the ticker wasn't functioning right, or maybe he had a little agita or heartburn, distress in the lower tract. I don't know.
We got a guy with a snowball in the front. All right, there's a guy yelling F you. Can we get...
Whoa.
I think we got him. No, we didn't. Oh, no. That's a bad mistake. Wait. There you go.
Oh, collateral damage. Collateral damage.
You know, this is the other thing that I wanted to talk about today. We talked a little bit about yesterday, is that one of the great leaders of the Christo-Fascist Zombie Brigade that goes under the name of... what's the name of his group? Christian... Oh, where is it? Focus on the Family.
Focus on the Family.
This guy, Dr. James Dobson, Focus on the Family, says that SpongeBob is probably gay. If not, you know, at least the way he's being used is to infiltrate the minds of our youngsters and plant the message of tolerance
for homosexuality.
And Lord knows that the Christo-Fascist Zombie Brigades are anti-tolerance.
Now, this is based on a video that was produced by Nile Rodgers. If any of you were dancing back in the disco days, you remember Nile Rodgers. He was a founding member of the group Chic. He wrote the song We Are Family. He founded the We Are Family Foundation in the wake of the September 11th terror attacks. He made this video in the wake of the attacks to send to schools to try and promote the idea of tolerance of difference. That's all.
Of difference, period.
Period.
So, of course, you know, Dobson locks onto this and says this is bad. This is a bad message for humanity, to tolerate other people who may be different than you. Everyone must think the same, and these things must be stopped. So we're going to investigate a little bit on our own. We're going to parse SpongeBob afterwards and try to get to the bottom of his sexuality on some level. But, you know, ultimately, hey, what difference does it make? Am I right? Why does it smell like something burned in here?
I'm wondering. Yeah.
Do you smell that, Kalo?
Yeah, I smell it.
Kalo Koskoho? Do you smell it?
There you go.
Do you smell something steamy?
I smell something, and it smells vaguely electrical.
Kalo, what are you doing this weekend, buddy?
Not doing anything. I'm just going to eat some cup of noodles and stuff. Are you sure it's not the cup of noodles you're smelling?
No, this is different.
It's different.
This is definitely different.
I'll look into it.
I hope, yeah. I'm
burning wire, I hope not.
And we're going to come back with SpongeBob SquarePants after this. It's 15 past the hour on America Radio.
I'm Reverend Al Sharpton, and you're listening to Morning Sedition. Talk about the issues we're fighting for our lives here on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
On Morning Sedition jamming. We had it going loud a second ago here.
Yeah, man.
That's one of those songs where you're like, oh, this song. And you just crank it up and blow your brains out. I mean, blow your brains out with the sound of love.
Why did that song remind me of Eric Burdon and the Animals?
Because it sounds like one
it's
of
my life.
Songs. It's my love, yeah. And I do dun, dun, what I want. Dun, dun, that's true. Dun, that's true. Dun, 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 dun. Yeah, you want to do the whole song?
Sure.
Come on. Dun, dun, dun. So I went to the therapist yesterday. And I cleaned my head. Though I'm a little anxious. I'm a little edgy. I'm a little edgy, but I have a dream from last night. I'm in Cobb County, Georgia, with my dead cat, Butch.
Uh-oh.
Hitting the road with Butch in the head. There's a school bus coming, and Butch jumps out in front of it. The bus squeals to a stop, and Butch and I get in. It's full of eighth graders. Butch says, "Comrades, where are you heading?" One kid says, "We're on our way to Bible camp." Butch says, "Not anymore, my friends. I will take you somewhere much more interesting." Then she tosses the driver out of the bus, takes the wheel, and drives until we get to a shack in the woods called Maynard's Roadhouse. Butch opens his bus door and says, "Get out, I'm buying." Inside, Butch snaps her fingers and says, "Bourbon, Rebel Yell." Maynard comes out and pours everyone a shot. Butch holds up the glass and says, "Let us drink to evolution." Got the voice right. And she drains it in one, and then she drains it all. She just drains it back, knocks it back, and then all the kids drink too and gasp and cough. One pimply kid says, "We have stickers in our textbook that say that evolution is only a theory. My daddy says evolution is secular humanist brainwashing by gay New York liberals." Butch slowly strokes his cheek with a sharp claw and says, "Comrade, you know many impressive words. Here's another to describe your father. Imbecile." She jumps on the table. "Evolution is not a theory. It is a fact. God, that is a theory. And the Bible? Fuck, Lemony Snicket speaks more truth." A skinny blonde girl says, What about intelligent design? Butch says, "I believe Calvin Klein can intelligently design a cocktail dress. Beyond that, those words are useless as a cow pie from Mary Callender." Butch tapped her temple with her claw. "When such superstitious nonsense is banished, then begins our own evolution. First, you will become Democrats, then socialists, and then anarchists, and then finally, you will become cats. Until then, the best thing you can do is start making filthy love as early and as often as possible. That is why we are drinking. Maynard, more Rebel Yell. The revolution won't wait." I woke up and my bed was filled with Georgia pine.
Wow.
Yeah, Butchie.
Wow.
Butch, staying alive in the dream zone.
And subverting kids.
I miss Butch, but I got so many other cats now. I got two cats in L.A. I got three cats in my house. It's unbelievable. I'm up to my neck in cats, Riley.
What happens to the cats when your wife leaves town and comes to Boston?
I'm meeting my wife in Boston. Don't say that because the terrorists would be like, "Oh, we're going to get both of them."
I'm sorry.
No,
you mean Cheney?
No, the cats, basically, if it's up to like 3 or 4 days in the house, well, you get the giant feeders, you know, the ones that just drop food down, the giant water feeders, and she, you know, sometimes just in the backup, you put a couple of bowls of food elsewhere and leave the toilet open in case something goes wrong. God forbid they get into a real panic, they can always, you know, find something
to drink, yeah.
The real issue is, you know, what happens with the poop? You know, but you know, those are some of the liabilities of having a cat. Sometimes they'll go off road in that department. So here we go.
Speaking of off road,
let's get back to this. The Christo Fascist Zombie Brigade. One of the regiments of the Christo Fascist Zombie Brigade that is a focus on the family. One of the captains in the Christo Fascist Zombie Brigade movement, Dr. James Dobson, has decided that SpongeBob, in a video by Niles Rogers, is doing nothing more than telling kids that it's okay to be gay. It's promoting acceptance.
It's yes. promoting tolerance, which is something that the Christo-fascist armed brigades cannot tolerate in any way. They do not want their kids to have a fact-based education, nor do they want them being tolerant of people who are different than them. But now, we did a little investigating yesterday. Come on, talk, man. You got to be able to talk. It's your job. All right. We did a little investigating yesterday. We listened to some SpongeBob. We're trying to get to the bottom of this. You know, gay, not gay. Is Dobson crazy? What do you got? Okay, well, let's hear that first snippet there.
I sleep with my shoes on. I like jelly on both sides of my toes. I've got an overdue library book. I've said the word fancy in conversation. I like to dance to loading zone announcements. I still don't have my driver's license. I'm a little on the short side. I'm wearing three pairs of underwear right now.
Nothing that unusual in the way of sexuality, though the jelly on both sides of the toast may be a thinly veiled metaphor.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to judge.
But that wouldn't be homosexuality. That would be bisexuality.
Hey, that would just be fun for some people. Let's hear the next one.
I'm exhausted. I sure can't wait to drink all these drinks.
Again, not necessarily a meaning of anything. It's hard to know what the drinks mean or what the situation is. But nothing inherently suggestive.
Well, no. I mean, it's not like there was YMCA in the background or something.
Yeah. Well, what do we got next?
Oops. I guess I ripped my pants again.
Again. A little questionable, but but still nothing really, nothing too suspicious. What's the last one there?
Okay, Patrick, it's all in the technique. First go like this, spin around, stop, then pelvic thrust. Don't forget it. Then you do this, then this, and this, then that, and this, and that, and this, and that, and this.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not going to judge. All right. And there's certainly nothing wrong with musical preferences or whatever. You know, it's certainly, I find it compelling and exciting. SpongeBob can be whatever he wants to be.
The real question here is whether or not Dobson's attack is going to cause some schools across this country to reject the video.
Really?
Because I think that's what his aim is. Yeah. I mean, it's going to 61,000 American schools in another 2 months.
These guys are just buzz killers. They just want everyone to think like them. They want everyone to wear the same outfit and sing the same song.
Well, no, these are folks who believe that their version of Christianity is the right version of Christianity. And anything that deviates from their right version or anything that says it's okay to tolerate something other than their version is going to be subject to attack.
And one of the Christo-fascist zombie brigade institutions, Bob Jones University, or BJU.
Couldn't he have thought of another name? God!
No, he's in love with himself.
Yeah.
And now his the fourth in line, Bob Jones 4, the fourth one, is taking over the school.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll talk about that when we come back.
Scary stuff. It's Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley, Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Please. Please, people. 34, past the hour. I'm Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
I'm Morning Sedition, Air America Radio. It's Friday. We've got our buffet of stuff here.
Yeah.
We can buy stuff today, right?
Sure.
Oh, good.
That was yesterday. Right,
that was yesterday. That was yesterday. This is today, man.
That's right. We're splurging in here.
We're going to talk about Jim Jones University, or Bob Jones, not Jim Jones. Jim Jones was an inspiration for Bob Jones University. We're going to talk about Bob Jones University, BJU. But first, thematically, we're working here. The Bible's Book of Revelations portends the end of days and the second coming of the Christian Messiah, and one of our president's favorite stories, as you all know. Though no one knows when the end times will come, there are signs that will appear to men. Here on Morning Sedition, we won't let you be caught off guard by the end of the world. That's why we present this week's Rapture Watch with Cardinal Milfington of the recently disgraced Diocese of Petaluma, California. Your Grace...
Heed unto yourselves, thou cave-dwelling Buddhists.
praying to your heathen goat god and shaving your heads while those around you struggle with male pattern baldness? Don't kill sentient beings. Meditate. Look inwards. Let go of your anger to avoid suffering. You are so obvious. Behold my heedings, Wiccans. Thou heady, high-minded, tree-hugging geeks. Even I don't take you seriously. And another thing, I'm sick of getting your s'mores stuck on my boots whenever I take a stroll in the forest. Cram this up your fire rings, nerds. Stevie Nicks is fat and sings off-key. I'd rather be tossed into a vat of scalding hot lion's vomit than listen to Belladonna again. Thrice hebdomadules ago, I spake it unto thee about the man who was arrested for drunk driving after downing 3 glasses of Listerine mouthwash. The week after that, I told you about a man who walked around for a whole week before he discovered he had a 4-inch constructed nail embedded in his brain. And the week after that, I told you if you see me walking around the house with my 3rd bottle of Listerine, don't be asking me to hold your nail gun while you go to the bathroom. Damn contractors, when are you going to finish with my blackout shutters? Last night while I was showering, a lemur peeked through my bathroom window and asked to talk to Mr. Starley. Man, I got to switch the scope. Heathens, the end times are nigh. For according to a bunch of sissy archaeologists from the British Museum, crusading American soldiers have inflicted widespread destruction on the ancient city of Babylon, causing worldwide concern over the damage. Now outraged nations around the globe wish to join together to help protect the city. And why is this bad? Great Nebuchadnezzar's ghost! Are you high on plax? It's a sign the beast will make his appearance. I'm not talking about Mr. Snarly in the shower again. I'm talking about Satan's one-world government, or even worse, the UN. For it was prophesied in Revelation 1 after 909, then I quoteth, "Fallen is Babylon, the kings of the earth committed fornication with her, and all the nations have drunk of the wine of her impure passion, a wine called Lavouris, containing spirit and 16 to 20% pure alcohol." End quoteth. Huh? Was that a lemur? I want my privacy. That Babylon was fated to become the seat of Satan's one-world government was only too clear to me after the release of Ishtar. I'm not blaming Satan for the script, nor this dated reference. But he had to be assistant director. I mean, look at the pacing. And as surely as Elaine May must spend an eternity paying for his sinful pride, so will you, blasphemers of the world, hang by your tongues over a fiery cesspool before ultimately falling and drowning in a bunch of cess. What? Whatever that is. Well, even now I can see you being pushed into a bottomless pit where you're stung by hordes of giant insects. Wow, look at the colors. Scope is great. Until next time, whoremongers of Babylon, keep on whoremongering, and we'll keep a light on for you. In hell!
Yeah, thank you, Cardinal. Thank you very much. Did you know that you got a weird fan letter, Cardinal?
Yeah, I got a fan letter.
Yeah. Yeah, listen to this. I am an attorney in Florida, and I'm married to a former member of the Socialist Party who used to drive by Ronald Reagan's mansion in California when he was governor and harbor very dark thoughts. He is now a pissed-off but upstanding Buddhist who practices medicine in Ocala, Florida. Now, basically they're saying, look, I was wondering if you would consider being his birthday gift. I have to confess I invited Al Franken first, and me. If I'm not mistaken, I got one of these letters as well. All right, if this is the same woman who got her husband.
How does it feel to be number 3 on the list, loser?
I think that'd be you, Cardinal. I think I might have been number 2, all right?
And another thing, what are you doing reading my personal mail? You know that's a violation, a federal violation.
Yeah. All right. So all right, so what happens?
What happens? We get down on our knees and we pray.
All right. Hey, look, he's a very funny, cool guy, and I promise you, you'll enjoy yourself. I think this is an invitation to some swinging.
Yeah.
What do you say
the two of us go out with them?
Are you going to bring the Lavouris or the scope?
I bring Lavouris. You bring your toupee.
I don't have a toupee.
Best, best in the business.
Oh, man. That's
you have right. A toupee.
I don't have a toupee.
You got a hunchback and you have one arm missing.
Well, now you're talking about yourself. And how'd that happen?
How'd that happen?
Yeah.
The burger wars. I don't know what happened. You're a veteran.
All right, please.
And I respect everything you did, by the way. You're a hero.
Thank you very much. So you want to get back to these people?
You want it?
Not really.
Come on.
Wait, we didn't talk about this before. Wait. I don't know. Look, I don't have much in my life.
All right.
You want to make fun of that, go ahead.
All right, Cardinal.
But I'm sure everybody on the blog doesn't have much of a life either. And I'm sure you're not making them very happy.
Why don't you take this letter, and I'm sorry I invaded your privacy, and think about it. I bet you'd do it. You like that. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I like that kind of thing?
Yeah, you do. I know you do. I do. All right. Get out. Get out.
That's good stuff.
Get out, bud. Thanks for being here, man. Making a seamless transition to a religious-themed show. Bob Jones III said Thursday he will retire as president of the Christian University that bears his name, ending a 34-year reign
of terror,
during which the school grabbed headlines because of its racial policies and fundamentalist views. Let's go over some of that there.
Well, it's simple. The racial policy? No blacks.
But it's baffling, man. It's horrendous. Bob Jones University is an unaccredited private school founded in 1927 by Baptist evangelist Bob Jones Sr. Now we're on the fourth one, apparently. In 1960, Jones Sr. claimed God is the author of segregation, and that if you're against it, then you're against God Almighty.
That's right.
What an ass.
The Lord said, sort them all out, each and every one of them, the blacks, the browns, the yellows, and don't let them mix.
Yeah, blacks were not admitted until the 70s, and then only unmarried blacks were permitted to apply. After 1975, the policy was changed, and instead, BJU enforced a ban on interracial marriages and dating.
What was that again?
BJU. Yeah. And that's the weird thing, is that they let unmarried black people in, and then when they get in, they go, oh, yeah, and you can't get married to anybody here.
No. And you best not even think about it.
A letter from the university in 1998 defended the ban on religious grounds. Quote, God has separated people for his own purpose. God has made people different one from another and intends those differences to remain. Bob Jones University is opposed to intermarriage of the races because it breaks down the barriers God has established. End quote. Bob Jones III announced on Larry King Live in 2000 that BJU was abandoning its policy banning interracial relationships. This is likely because the Supreme Court had upheld the IRS's decision to revoke BJU's tax-exempt status because it practiced racial discrimination. And also, this dude, Bob Jones III, is the guy who wrote that letter to President Bush.
To President Bush, yeah.
Quote, in your reelection, God has graciously granted America, though she doesn't deserve it, a reprieve from the agenda of paganism. You have been given a mandate. Put your agenda on the front burner and let it boil. You owe the liberals nothing. They despise you because they despise your Christ. Well, guess who's going to be left hanging out to dry, buddy? You and yours. That's what I think. In 2000, while the school still banned interracial relationships, Bush made his first campaign stop after losing the New Hampshire primary at BJU. Seeking a conservative bounce, Bush told students, quote, I look forward to publicly defending my conservative philosophy, end quote.
Yeah.
Also homophobic. That is, BJU.
Yeah. They don't like gays or blacks.
In 1998, when a gay 60-year-old alum asked if he could come back to visit the school, the dean of students wrote back, quote, with grief, we must tell you that as long as you are living as a homosexual, you, of course, would not be welcome on the campus and would be arrested for trespassing if you did. We take no delight in that action. Our greatest delight would be in your return to the Lord, end quote. How do you like that? Here's some rules. A female graduate of Bob Jones described her years as a student in a personal account published in 2000 in Esquire magazine. Sidewalks are painted pink, girls only, and blue, men only. Students are allowed to hang posters if they were of puppies or flowers of Christian sayings. Mm. And I'm assuming Jesus.
Yes.
Puppies, dogs.
And Jesus.
And Jesus and poetry. Students may not leave campus without a signed permission slip. Bedtime is 11 p.m. Wake-up time is 6:55 a.m. No TV. You may not sit closer than 6 inches to a person of the opposite sex, or you will be placed on spiritual probation. Wow, that's heavy. What does that even mean?
Spiritual probation.
Spiritual probation. That sounds... I would see that as a reprieve.
Yeah.
You know, that's fun time, yeah, it would seem. Women must wear dresses below the knee. Men must wear ties until lunchtime. And after lunch, this is
okay.
Daily chapel attendance is mandatory. No homosexuals, as we said. Off-campus dates must be chaperoned by faculty. Anyone who violates the rules will be given demerits. Tattooing is encouraged. This is great.
Yeah. Rat out
your friend in the name of God. Griping will not be tolerated, but rats will. No complaining, no speaking up for yourself. But if you want to rat out your friend, you can. We've got a bunch of new rules that are going to be coming in as Bob Jones the IV takes over. I think he's called.
No,
himself
he calls
Steve
himself.
Jones.
Steve. Could you imagine if Jack Johnson had ever tried to apply to Bob Jones University?
Jack Johnson. I'm in the second half of that.
Yeah.
I watched the first half twice.
Yeah, because we had Ken Burns on earlier this week. And
that was
I could just imagine Jack. Because remember now, Bob Jones University was founded in 1927.
Yes, it was.
Jack Johnson, that's the same year Jack Johnson wrote his book.
When he beat the crap out of that guy, Jim Jeffries.
Jim Jeffries. 1910.
Race riots around in almost every state of the country.
Led by Bob Jones.
Yeah. Maybe. Maybe. He probably led a couple.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that. So we'll talk about what the plans of Bob Jones for are in updating BJU after this. It's 45 past the hour here on Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Reverend Barry Lynn from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. You know, with George W. Bush in charge, the weather forecast calls for Armageddon. That's why I stay prepared by tuning in to Rapture Watch with MILF Cardinal Milfington on Morning Sedition, Air America Radio.
Fun?
Play that pop music. 50 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. It's Friday. Thank God, I tell you, man, being a comic for as many years as I was, I didn't realize the pure joy of Fridays when one has to work for the living every day. Wow. Man, I am so sick of looking at some of you guys. I'm kidding, man. Not you.
No, he's not.
You know,
he's not kidding.
I looked right past Riley, right past Kayla, right into the booth.
No,
I'm kidding. Right past the booth into the wall.
Ooh.
Oh no, I can't backpedal now. It doesn't have anything to do with you guys.
Et tu, Bob Jones?
The thing is about Clutch Larson, who's in the booth, who I love. Yeah, a lot of, you know, whatever goes on here in this studio, you don't realize that I'm on the phone with him for at least a half hour to 45 minutes every night. I call him on weekends, on Sunday, and it's not even about show stuff. It's basically just sort of like, all right, what are you looking at? What's on there? Really? And then we end up just talking about it. It's kind of sad that I'm revealing this. But
your girlfriend.
Look, I'm alone. Yeah, we're sort of like we're having an affair on the phone, which is safe, and it's non-sexual. But I got nothing to do. You know, I'm sort of like, after I clean up the cat poop, I'm sort of like, I'm going to call Larson, you know, and it sort of goes like that.
You know, yesterday I said you and I were going to hang out. You and I are going to hang out.
We're
going
to
have to do some walking on the wild side.
I'm going to make you smoke a cigar. I haven't smoked a cigar in a few days because I have this festering nightmare on my face. Thank you for all the input. I swear to God, we can talk about George Bush. We can talk about Social Security. We can talk about restricting victims' rights, religious fanaticism. But, man, I mentioned my cold sore for, like, less than one segment the other day, and I'm getting more emails than I know what to do with about how to treat my cold sore and how to look out for it. A couple ones I didn't know about. I knew about lysine. That's an amino acid. But someone told me that there are certain foods like cheese and popcorn that actually restrict or block lysine, so you know that can encourage.
And you eat a lot of popcorn.
Sometimes I do.
Yeah.
And also the acidophilus cure, I did not know about.
Really?
You know, yeah.
And well, you can't smoke a cigar when you have a cold sore. That's what I said. Doesn't work.
No, I know. And it's good, though, because I don't want to smoke cigars. I'm just doing it because it gets me all juiced up. I got nothing to look forward to in the afternoon. You know, like I said, hello, kitties. What's going on? Oh, pretty soon I'm going to sleep. Here, I'll feed you guys. Now I'm going to sit and read and smoke a cigar. But lately, I'm getting all jammed on the nicotine running my Jerusalem Syndrome show.
Uh-oh.
Yep, getting ready for the Poway gig. Tonight, Jimmy Tingles, Off-Broadway Theater, Somerville, Massachusetts. And tomorrow, come on down. Nothing to be afraid of. I swear. So we're talking about Bob Jones University, BJU, and some of their horrendous rules.
Creeps.
Yeah, but now I guess Bob Jones IV, better known as Steve Jones.
That's A.K.A.
Not the guitar player for the Sex Pistols. Is going to change things. And here's a list of goals from Stephen Jones to bring Bob Jones University into the next generation. Because his father, Bob Jones III, said he wants to turn the reins over to his son, who is 35 years old, because he thinks that, you know, us old fuddy-duds can really stiffen things up. We want a little breathing room. We want to bring the next generation in. We want to embrace the new kids in the fold. So here's a list of goals that Stephen Jones has to bring to Bob Jones University. One, go from no interracial dating to no interracial dating in internet chat rooms. A little progress, right?
Sure.
Two, defend a woman's right to choose to go to a Planned Parenthood office and scream at scared teenage girls. Okay. Three, We will no longer refer to Catholicism and Mormonism as cults. They will now be called terrorists. Ford developed cutting-edge anti-masturbation technology, and we do mean cutting-edge.
Ooh.
Hey, owie. Five, denigrate foreigners' belief systems using hard rock and Christian emo bands. Yeah. Six, demonstrate why the Jews are God's cursed people using PowerPoint demonstration.
Whoa.
And here you'll see the modern Jew. All right. Seven, build a bridge to other religions, then cross that bridge and subjugate them.
Wow.
Moving into the new world, the new generation of Bob Jones University students.
Stephen Jones, 35 years old, continuing the tradition of cross burnings and racism that have made the South such a wonderful place for black people for so long.
And here we go. Yesterday we reported that a Spanish bishop or a spokesperson for the Spanish Catholic Church said that...
condoms okay!
It's okay. It's okay. It's going to stop disease and the spread of Catholics. He didn't say that. But...
No.
Condom
bueno.
Within seconds of him making that announcement... the church said, whoa, 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 whoa. Who's the loudmouth? Who's the loose cannon speaking the truth?
Yep.
And they shut him down.
Yeah, they said, well, we really didn't mean that condoms were okay. We're going back to our fallback position, which is no contraception whatsoever. It's rhythm or nothing.
It's unbelievable. There's no sign that Pope John Paul II is wavering from the ban on contraception. On the other hand, in recent statements on moral issues facing Catholics, contraception has not taken its usual place alongside abortion and other prohibited practices. In the 1995 Evangelium Vitae, is that how you pronounce it? I'm not good at Latin. Or Gospel of Life document, the pontiff lumped contraception with abortion and euthanasia as practices embraced by, quote, a civilization of affluence and pleasure that exists as though sin did not exist and as if God did not exist. Affluence and pleasure.
What was he talking about, Rome?
Who the hell are you to have a good time? That's what I want to know. Don't you believe in God? There's no time for fun. Please, put that thing away. Well, what if I wrap it?
Wait, what do you mean by put that thing away?
What if I wrap it? No! There is none of that.
That's right.
The only thing that's to be used for is creating and spreading Catholicism. That is all we do.
Wow.
His teachings on contraception closely track dogma laid down by one of his predecessors, Pope Paul VI, who said that each and every marital act must of necessity retain its intrinsic relation to procreation of life, i.e.,
no condoms.
More Catholics.
Wow, that's an interesting way of putting it, though, isn't it?
What?
You know, it must intrinsically be a part of, you know, having kids is essentially what they're trying to say.
And Hillary Clinton has begun the process of the great Christian ass-kissing.
Well, she went up to the Ella Baker Center up in Boston, or actually an Ella Baker Center dinner. And we'll tell you a little bit later on exactly what it was she was doing. We're also going to deconstruct a little counterculture in our next hour, Mark.
Love this book.
Yeah.
Nation of Rebels, Why Counterculture Became Consumer Culture. Got to get ready to take a few hits.
Yeah, so get ready to duck when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Having trouble.
I'm Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, socialists, anarchists that want to laugh. Good morning to you, all of you, the guilt-ridden, the bullies, and the, you know, those of you who are willing to sacrifice your personalities out of fear of being rejected. Good morning to you.
Oh, that would be me.
We're going to come talk a little bit about that later with our guests. We got some pretty interesting stuff coming up. We've got Joseph Heath and Andrew Potter, author of A Nation of Rebels, Why Counterculture Became Consumer Culture. They're going to discuss the illusion of nonconformity and how the counterculture is perfectly capitalist. It's pretty interesting stuff. I'm literally almost done with the book. I was jamming to get to the end of it. But, like, you know what I do, Riley? I get one of these books like this, mm-hmm. and I underline everything.
Really?
Yeah, you know, I underline so much. I make notes on the margins because, you know, a lot of times I don't remember stuff. How's your reading comprehension? You're pretty good at it. I mean, you'll parse stories and bang, it all pops right in your head. I got to, you know, underline the good parts and think about things. I got to go back. It's pretty dense stuff.
Well, yeah, the discussion of culture, counterculture, and consumer culture. I really believe that the reason why hippies became consumers was because everything got so cheap. You know, I mean, the bottom line is the price of the most wanted gadgets in America goes down, whether it's plasma TVs, iPods, or whatever.
With demand
and time.
Yeah.
You know, they start out being $5,000. Next thing you know, they're $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a tremendous, and you know, you've got all of these different places that say buy, buy. There's a store called Buy Bye Baby, but it's spelled B-U-Y.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it really is about constantly being bombarded.
They'll argue with that.
Well, I know they'll argue with it. Let's argue with them. They're Canadians. No. I'll argue.
No, but they make a pretty good case about a lot of things. You know, their idea is not so much. It has less to do with advertising than it does to do with demand. That, you know, they say that, you know, all this sort of like coercive advertising stuff. They say that most of advertising, you know, especially if you know the brand, is relatively ineffectual.
How do you know the brand?
Well,
advertising.
You know, no, but after a certain point of time, you know, it just becomes cultural momentum.
Yeah, but the initial stages have to be advertised. You got to let people know that you got a product. Otherwise, nobody's going to buy it because they won't know it exists.
Yeah, with some products, but not all products. I mean, their assumption is that, you know, once you develop a relationship with a product and once you start to have certain expectations, that just cultural momentum, word of mouth, people relying on it, will actually take care of most of the advertising.
What are they talking about?
One of the great examples, any of the franchise stores, any of the, you know, sort of big chains, any, you know, clothing manufacturers like the Gap and stuff like that. How much do they really need to advertise? How much does McDonald's really advertise? How much effect does McDonald's advertising really have on people?
Well, now that's an interesting point, because if you look at the history of McDonald's, and remember that McDonald's was one of a number of fast food franchises that began in the late 1950s. There was Wetson's, there was Val's, there were all these different fast food franchises. What made McDonald's different?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that, A, they were all over the place. B, they all tasted everywhere. No matter where you went, they were all exactly the same. And that was reinforced by the way they positioned themselves in the advertising marketplace.
Well, but over time, giving that...
Over time, yeah. I don't disagree that over time. But the initial push, the initial thing that, in my judgment, made McDonald's different from the other places, which are no longer here. You can't find a Wetson's anywhere in America.
Well, also the what made it different was the assembly line nature which they presented the food. The drive through was what made
it
different.
But they all
did that. And also consistency and the franchise model.
The franchise model was an important.
Well, I think most of their argument is not so much whether or not advertising works or not. It's whether or not they make an argument that says that the system, the idea that we are all conformists, or that there is a system, or that there is a uniformity, or that, you know, there is such a thing as a sellout, or these kind of things. They're just BS words. That he's saying that the reason uniformity and
he must not have met Armstrong Williams yet.
Well, no, but
there's no such thing as a sellout.
Well, no, but they're talking in relation to, they say that the reason something becomes popular is because people like it. You know, that they're I'm talking about selling out, like, in a good example of somebody, something like U2, when people say U2 sold out because now everybody likes
them. No, not this again.
No, what they say is the reason why is because, you know, it became popular, not because anything happened on behalf of U2, just more people started to like them, and then what happens is the loyalists say, well, screw them. They don't belong to us anymore. We're going to find something new. And they make arguments to say that those people that believe they're living marginal, exciting lives at the cutting edge of whatever they think they're doing, unique lives, are, you know, ultimately cutting the path for new markets, you know, whether they like it or not. And some of them, they believe, actually know that. So I think it's a pretty broad stuff. Now let's talk about Senator Hillary Clinton. This was a speech she gave. You mentioned this woman earlier.
Ella Baker. Ella J. Baker. One of the icons of the civil rights movement. Someone that very few people outside of the black community know about. Her work spanned generations. I mean, this is a woman who was born in 1903, graduated college in the early 1920s, and was her civil rights work was extraordinary. She was one of the people that got involved in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference founded by Dr. King, and then split with Dr. King at the end of the 1950s, and was the founder of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC.
Yeah.
And the most militant, radical black people in America deferred to Ella J. Baker.
So now, this event... Had less to do with Ella Baker, per se.
Well, it's the dinner is named in her honor.
Right. But this was about Hillary Clinton making inroads into the black religious community.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, supporting faith-based initiatives.
Yes.
And basically beginning a presidential campaign.
Well, it could be that, yeah. I mean, what she's doing, I think, is trying... I think Hillary Clinton recognizes that there's a segment of the black community that does not have a particular problem with taking advantage of all that faith-based initiative money. So what she's essentially saying is, it's not that bad to take advantage of of the money that is out here. Remember, too, that Bill Clinton supported a law that banned the federal government from discriminating against religious organizations that were seeking funding available to groups, any group, that was delivering social services. Now, you do have to draw the line, and I'm kind of disappointed, quite frankly, because I don't see it here. You have to draw a line at some point and say that, you know, faith-based organizations that try to promote their faith as they deal these social services, that's a problem. Uh-huh. I got a problem with that.
Uh-huh.
If you're delivering, because, you know, the church I belong to, they deliver social, we do situations where, you know, homeless people stay in the church.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't consider that, and they're not, you know, they're not preached at while they're there. It is simply someplace for them to stay.
Yeah.
And I don't have a problem with that. I wouldn't even have a problem if the federal government helped them out with a few dollars every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get to the point, as a place like Bob Jones University does, for example, where the faith comes with the service, okay? In other words, you provide, you know, help for drug addicts. Yeah, but then you say to these drug addicts, well, you know, if you found God, our God, you'd be better. That I got a problem.
Or else, if not only that, but you're not going to get your methadone until you say you're going to vote for Bush. How about that?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the real issue, isn't it? That's where the issue of blurring church and state comes, that becomes an issue. It's one thing, yeah, obviously, faith-based initiatives are going to have something to do with faith, but what about when they start doing political favors? It became pretty clear on some level that Bush was giving money to specific faiths, number one, and to specific institutions that he knew would somehow garner support for his campaign. They couldn't do it outwardly, or they denied their non-for-profit status, but they certainly could do it suggestively. And I think that is the real issue, isn't it?
Well, it is the real issue, because what you have, Mark, is a situation where the pastors of these various churches now have a vested interest in maintaining whatever the status quo is that got them the funding in the first place. In other words, if Bush funded them, why would they want to get rid of him?
Right. So let's talk about Howard Dean when we come back. It looks like he's going to be the guy. There's some momentum behind him.
Yeah.
And maybe that'll lead us nicely into our guests, the authors of Nation of Rebels, Why Counterculture Became Consumer Culture. Joseph Heath and Andrew Potter are going to be on the phone with us from Canada, where it rains free Prozac. 15 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
It's just a wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Alert.
Twenty past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. It is Friday. Tonight I will be at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater in Somerville, Massachusetts, along with Tomorrow. Can I say along with Tomorrow? Can you say along with in
of course you can.
Days? I will be there tomorrow as well. I'll be leaving here and going up there. Oh, my God. Here we go. Ramon brought this earlier today and wearing a Napoleonic hat. And epaulettes, George W. Bush's Palm Pilot for today, January 21st, 7 a.m. Wake up, stare in mirror. They put me back in office. Even I don't get this. 9 a.m. breakfast, stack of Texas-sized flapjacks and a half a pint of Jim Beam. Note, the days of living for them are over.
Uh-oh.
The days of living for me have just begun. 10 a.m. Attend National Prayer Service, Washington National Cathedral. Note, I'm beginning to wonder about this whole prayer thing. These damn terrorists pray 3-4 times a day. Look where that's got them. 1 p.m. Find out who hit Cheney's car with a snowball, then hand him over to Gonzalez and his boys as a little inauguration present. 2 p.m. Call police department in Rio de Janeiro. Have American ambassador bail out the twins. Note, never take your eyes off of those two. 6 p.m. Build true bipartisan coalition to help heal this country's deep ideological divisions. Hey, who put this in here? 9 p.m. Flop on the couch, drink Jim Beam, and watch rodeo. Note, I rule the world. How do you like that? But we're going to fight back. We're going to fight back by holding up Condoleezza Rice's confirmation hearings by a couple of days.
Yeah.
We're going to fight back by chipping away at Social Security proposal. Hopefully we're going to win that fight. And also we're going to fight back by perhaps looking like maybe Howard Dean will be the new DNC chairman.
Dems drifting toward Dean.
What do you think of that, Mark Reilly?
I'm kind of surprised, to be honest with you. I thought that the anti-Dean, moderate Democratic Leadership Council forces on the DNC would have prevailed, or they would have lined up behind somebody. They apparently have not. Right now, it looks like the only person that's in line to stop Howard Dean is Congressman Barney Frank's guy, Martin Frost, the former congressman from Texas.
Do you know anything about him?
Very little, except he lost.
He lost his last election. Well, we're going to find out some stuff about a lot of these people in the next couple of weeks. We're going to be talking to some of them. But, you know, Dean, to me, he represents a certain amount of passion. He represents a certain amount of focus, a certain amount of honesty, a certain amount of integrity around the core issues of what the Democratic Party should be about. It's not necessarily, obviously he's not a moderate, but he's not going to, try and move the Democratic Party to this mythical center where we start to, lose the distinction between us and what they are doing.
Well, see, I only really have one concern about the chair of the DNC.
What?
Can we get him on Morning Sedition? And we've had Howard Dean on before. So
a few times.
I'm for Dean. he's a guy we can get.
We've never had any trouble getting those guys on. We talked to...
Well, Terry McAuliffe.
Terry McAuliffe. Exactly. Why would we have any problem getting him on? I just hope that it's enough that, that not only he can do the fundraising necessary, but he can energize the effort. I mean, the one great thing about Dean, in retrospect, was his ability to mobilize people. And, if that's what's needed to get people mobilized and engaged in the political process on local levels, on fundraising levels, on all levels, then he's the guy to do it.
Oh, I fully agree with you. I mean, look, I thought that Wellington Webb would be an interesting compromise candidate in the event that something happened and Dean didn't get it. Mm-hmm. Wellington Webb has problems, however, with unions, particularly in his home city of Denver. He had some union problems when he was mayor there, and that made him a less than attractive candidate to organize labor. Rosenberg, the guy out of the West Coast, the Silicon Valley guy, is a centrist. He is a DLC sort of guy. Donnie Fowler has been a lot of people thought Donnie Fowler would have made a better showing as well, that he would be one of those compromise candidates. Right now, according to this article that we're looking at, Martin Frost is kind of billing himself as the compromise candidate.
The anti-Dean.
Now, I don't know whether the party really has the organizational skills to stop Howard Dean. Now, they did it when he ran for president. I'm not sure they're in a position to do it now. They seem to be leaderless, rudderless, and utterly loveless.
Why the hell would they want to stop him? You got a guy here that's got genuine charisma. He has genuine passion.
They're scared he'll lose.
They've got the capability to mobilize young people in the political process. I mean, that's what this needs. Not a bunch of wealthy Democrats sitting there, piddling around, thinking about, how we can become more centrist, more moderate. I mean, this is a guy that might actually succeed in getting my generation and younger actively involved in local politics, in national politics, in fundraising, in redefining what the core values of the party are. Yet these guys are sitting there going, oh, no, he's scary. Screw them.
See, here's the problem, Mark. When it comes to getting people active who do not now vote, most Democrats don't give a crap. That's the problem.
The mistake.
Of course it's a mistake, but it's the same logic that uses. And that is, you try to get the people that you already got.
But that's ridiculous. I mean, okay, so we already got these people, but the truth of the matter is, somebody like Dean, I'll tell you one thing, I never heard Terry McAuliffe or Joe Lockhart or any of these guys do, is convince me that they believed in the values of the Democratic Party. These people would list, you know, oh, what are we doing? We're, you know, education, you know, we're going to try and get health care, you know.
And you black guys, you're part of the base, aren't you? We don't have to really worry about
but
you. Go to a few churches, everything will be fine.
The thing that was amazing about Dean was that, you know, he actually sounded and came across, and I believed in the core values of the Democratic Party.
He had an energy. Last year, they had a debate here in Lower Manhattan with the presidential candidates. This is before Kerry jumped out in front of the whole group. I was going downtown to cover the debate, and I see a crowd of people standing in front of a train station by City Hall. I'm thinking, what in the world is going on? I look up, and there's Howard Dean speaking to about 300 people, and they're going crazy. I go around to where the debate's actually taking place, and all the other candidates had clusters of maybe 10 people with signs and posters, and there was no candidate in sight, not John Kerry, none of them.
Yeah, I tell you, man, the old school moderate centrist Democrats have got to wake the hell up and realize that the one thing they got to do is to energize a new wave of Democrats in believing the core values of the party. And the reason they don't believe that's important is because they don't believe it themselves anymore. They don't know what they are, and they don't really work towards them. Do they really care about helping the unfortunate? Do they really care about taking care of the working people's problems? Do they really? I don't know. But I'll tell you one thing, that this guy, Howard Dean, could get young people involved in local politics and in national politics, and that's the only thing that's going to save the Democratic Party.
All right.
We're going to be back with these guys to talk about consumerism and the counterculture. What happened to the counterculture? Get ready, progressives. It sounds like you might be in a futile fight.
This is Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley, Mornings Edition on Air America Radio. If you're what?
Thirty-four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. In just a second, we'll be talking to Joseph Heath and Andrew Potter, the authors of Nation of Rebels, Why Counterculture Became Consumer Culture. But first, I got to take this call. Ted in Nebraska, how are you?
I'm all right, Mark and Mark. You know, you just can't enjoy the inauguration, can you? It's a great moment
happening.
For America.
Oh, no, I hate when... help me, Riley. Oh, my God. Oh, no, it's happening. My thoughts are starting to change. I'm becoming him. Oh, no.
Hell, Pennsylvania.
Live from Radio Halliburton, it's Right and Early, the conservatives' way to wake up with Mark the Shark Maron.
Good morning, neocons. It's 20 after the hour here on Radio Halliburton. Halliburton, installing American presidents since 2000. Was that inauguration the best thing ever? Huh? Was it? Huh? Oh, my God. Oh, yes. Oh, my God. Whoa, mandate. Is this the second term or the second coming? Oh, both. Wow, do Republicans know how to rock or what? They got Hillary Duff and Reuben Stoddard. Whoa, Mark the Shark hit the wrong button. That's more like it. Like the kids say, he's the bomb. Speaking of explosions. I mean Condi Rice. I mean Condi Rice. Yeah, she shot down those liberals on the Foreign Relations Committee.
Oh, my name's Barbara Boxer. I'm from California, and I hate Connie because she's a real woman, and I'm short and angry and a lesbian.
Hey, how did John Kerry get in here?
Hi, I'm John Kerry. I'm a loser, and I voted against Connie because I'm a loser. Could you recount my vote and Barbara's, too?
Yeah, Kerry, I'll count your vote, and this little troll's, too. Yeah, there's one.
Yeah, and there's two. You still lose, losers. Four more years. Right you are. There you go. We got a caller. Let's take a call. How are you, caller?
Oh, those damn liberals, feminazis, tax and spend.
That's right you are. That's right. They should just poop can those elections in Iraq and just make W their president, too. Hey, it's 24 after the hour. Time for the neocon power weather forecast. It's the next few weeks. It looks like, well, it's going to start raining. Missiles in Iran. That's a little hail from the chief, if you know what I'm saying. That's right. Yeah, stick around, neocons. We'll be back with Toby Keith.
Don't touch that dial, Patriot. We'll be back with Right and Early.
Oh, man. What just happened? I'm just getting all ready for that interview.
You all right, man?
I just hate when I have these weird panic attacks. I don't even know what they are. I just need some medicine.
Oh.
But I think I'm focused.
Yeah, you're all right.
This book that I've been reading, The Nation of Rebels, Why Counterculture Became Consumer Culture, is a pretty interesting indictment of progressive movements. It's a very interesting analysis of why the counterculture does not really function as a counterculture. The authors are. They are Joseph Heath and Andrew Potter. Joseph is a professor in the philosophy department at the University of Toronto. Andrew is a research fellow at the University of Montreal. And we have them on the phone and sort of in the studio at the ISDN line. How are you, fellas?
I'm good. Hi, are you?
Great.
It's nice to talk to you. So now, you know, your book's blowing my mind a little bit. And it says basically that some, if not all, progressive countercultural movements and tactics since the 60s, especially those that aim to rebuild or destroy the system, are futile and really just reinventing capitalism. On some level, I think that's what you're saying. So in what you capture as the 60s idealism was just sort of an awkward growth spurt of capitalism. Is that true?
I hate to do this, but maybe I can start by quibbling a little bit.
Okay.
We're actually not indicting progressive movements. What we're actually indicting is specifically countercultural movements.
Okay, good. Okay.
In other words, we think that, you know, back in the 60s, there was actually a big difference between the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, mm-hmm. the feminist movement, and then the hippie counterculture coming out of San Francisco. In the 60s, those were very distinct things. In the 70s, they got kind of blended in people's minds so that people no longer really sort of make any difference at all between, you know, punk and hippie counterculture.
So the melting of dissent and deviance is what you talk about in the book, the border between them.
Yeah, we try to argue that, look, there's a difference between sort of sticking it to the man, which is the countercultural prescription, and progressive social policy, and that often the two of them are in tension with one another.
So it seems to me that, you know, some of these things, how do countercultural movements, you know, become markets? Because you're sort of saying that a lot of them sort of were there to begin with, that, you know, the actual intent of the idea of the individual or the idea of the renegade or the idea of, like, you know, free thinking is actually somehow, you know, part of the momentum of capitalism.
Yeah, we actually argue that the counterculture was intensely entrepreneurial from the very start.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what drove it was the idea that, well, if the man is making, you know, stuff you don't like, movies you don't like, then go see, you know, an underground theater or do avant-garde art. If you don't like the music that the man is putting out on Top 40 radio, you know, start your own garage band and so on. And so, you know, we kind of point out how a lot of, you know, the brands that people complain about now, Starbucks and The Gap, for instance, both came out of countercultural movements in Seattle in 1971 with Starbucks and at The Gap in 1969 in San Francisco. So that's sort of why we're saying that it had sort of, it is the true spirit of capitalism is embodied in a lot of countercultural ideals.
Well, that's what I really like about your book, because I did comedy for years, and I always was sort of baffled and amazed at, you know, doing stand-up for what they call alternative audiences, is that you have all these people that consider themselves sort of rugged individualists wearing roughly the same thing, you know, horn-rimmed glasses and windbreakers and work shirts. And, you know, it seems to me that what I like about your book is it really talks about the counterculture as sort of a class, and also, you know, being classist in its own way.
Yeah, our basic observation is that the story we've been told about consumerism since the 1960s has a pretty obvious problem in it. And that story says that basically consumerism is about conformity, that we all just want to fit in, which is why we go out and buy all this stuff. And that in itself just makes no sense. If all we wanted to do was fit in, then everybody would go out and buy exactly the same stuff, and everybody would be finished, right? Mm-hmm. We'd all be happy. But just look at, the stuff you buy. I look at the stuff I buy. I mean, I don't buy it because I want to fit in. I buy it because I want to in some way stand out. I want to, represent my individuality. What I'm after is distinction. But that has a competitive logic. Right, so as soon as I buy the latest sort of cool underground CD or what have you, the problem is that if they really sound good, then other people are going to start buying the same thing. As soon as other people start buying the same thing, then I'm no longer such an individual, or I'm no longer such a rebel. So I've got to go out and find something new to buy. And so the counterculture itself is often contributing to competitive consumption, precisely because rebellion is something that necessarily puts you into competition with everybody else.
Well, okay, that's really interesting. And part of this thinking leads you to sort of defend the idea of uniforms in school. And I want to talk about that when we come back. We will be right back here with Joseph Heath and Andrew Potter. The book is Nation of Rebels, Why Counterculture Became Consumer Culture. It's 42 past the hour on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, on the air and online at MorningSedition.com from Air America Radio.
Threatening to commit suicide on stage, right? I mean, it should be obvious to us all now that just being a nonconformist is no threat to the system. The system just doesn't require that much conformity. So, the story is that, Kali Lassen, the editor of Adbusters, has this little vignette in his book Culture Jam about how he gets really upset at the supermarket because he's forced to put a quarter into his little shopping cart. And so he, jams the quarter in so that the shopping cart is now broken. And he's like, and he actually presents this as him kind of sticking it to the man.
Right.
We take this as just a really great example of how this sort of rebellious individuality, what it amounts to is simply a demand that the sort of people wait on you hand and foot, right?
Yeah.
Because the guy lives in Vancouver where there's a little organic vegetable grocery store on every single corner of every block in the downtown area. I mean, he doesn't have to go to a big impersonal supermarket. If he's going to the big impersonal supermarket, it's because he doesn't feel like paying, $8 for a mango. it's cheaper, right?
Yeah.
That's why. And the reason it's cheaper is they don't have to hire people to run around chasing down shopping carts.
Yeah.
So, he wants to sort of, have his cake and eat it too, right?
Yeah.
He wants to be an individual. At the same time, he doesn't want to, pay a lot for groceries. But I'm sorry, if your individuality requires that, three or four people be hovering around behind you saying all the time, can I help you? Can I get you? Can I help you with that mango? Whatever. I mean, if that's what your individuality requires, then you should be prepared to pay $8 for a mango, right?
Right.
It's incredible. Is there no middle ground, gentlemen? I mean, my thing is, I guess I must be a hedonist by this kind of thing, because I've always consumed what I liked. It wasn't about rebelling or sticking it to the man. I went through a period, obviously, because I was a child of the civil rights movement. There were things, certainly in the black community, in my community, that I wanted to see change. But in terms of consumption, I've always, kind of done what I liked. Is there a problem with that?
Well, there's not necessarily a problem with buying stuff. I mean,
I don't buy stuff just to be buying it. I buy it because I like it. Particularly when it comes to music. I'm a fanatic about music. If I hear a song that I like, I have to find it.
Well, one of the arguments we make in the book is that there's no such thing as pure or innocent expressions of taste, that everyone's tastes are intrinsically comparative. So the fact that you like something, you might like it, but it's not just what you're buying that matters. It's what you're not buying. So it's good if you like U2 and you like REM and so on, but if you're going around saying, well, I'd buy this, but I'd never buy Celine Dion, or I'd never buy a Chrysler or something like this, then you're creating that sense of distinction that's at the heart of all consumerism.
Yeah.
And so you actually are... still playing the game, but if you're actually refusing to buy things on the basis of judgments of taste.
Well, I wouldn't see. My thing is, I might buy one thing and illegally download something else. I mean, my taste is what I like.
And that's all fine, and good for you. The point is, you're not saving the world by doing this. You probably never thought you were saving the world.
Absolutely not.
But the argument that came out of the 60s, and that is still a strong part of countercultural thinking, is that by being a rebel consumer, you're a threat to the system. By refusing to buy, one of the cars that Detroit is trying to sell you, by going out and buying a VW Beetle or whatever, right? Back in the 60s, that was regarded as a threat to the system.
Now, now you're
and
just
we're just arguing that, look, that's not a threat. That just is the system. That's how it works.
Right, people that's like your marketing group. Your countercultural, sort of ideology has now become just a demographic. Now, let me ask you this, then. So you're saying on some level that we have to accept the system, that globalization is a reality, and this is the way the thing is set up. So how do progressives change things? What does facilitate change?
Well, I mean, we're sort of old-fashioned square, as we say. You know, change happens incrementally, and you're not going to overthrow the system. We're not going to smash the state. We're not going to smash globalization. And what we're against is not globalization. I think we think you've got to sort of accept that. What we're against is what we say, we're against bad practices. And bad practices happen at all levels. You can find bad things going on at the municipal level, at the state level, at the federal level, at the global level.
Well, what's good? Well, how can we change it? Just by getting involved with local politics?
Well, local politics, but what we argue is that a big problem is that this whole think locally or act locally, think globally ideal is actually causing a lot of the problems, because people think that, you know, you can just sort of solve problems by acting in your own backyard. So if you're worried about pollution in the world, we'll recycle. And we say that's not helping.
What helps?
A lot of the problems, global warming, say, for instance, the big problem. Global warming isn't going to be solved by local people recycling. It's only going to be solved by large-scale international agreements between governments.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we're big proponents of old-fashioned politics and legislative solutions. In other words, we don't think individual consumer activism is that effective. We want legislative responses to, you know, serious environmental problems, for example.
Well, thanks for joining us. We got to get out. We got to go, fellas.
All right.
But I really enjoy the book, and I enjoyed talking to you. It's Nations of Rebels: Why Counterculture Became Consumer Culture. Joseph Heath, Andrew Potter. Good talking to you.
Thanks a lot.
That was pretty interesting. I didn't mean to cut him off at the end there, but like I said, this book is very dense. It's gonna rustle a lot of feathers, but also there's a lot of very practical stuff in there, and it really forced me to sort of say, what am I made out of? It really did. There's the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Here are your marching orders today. One, start referring to yourself as a mistreated veteran of the inauguration. Two, post-inauguration protest meeting. Review video of yesterday's events and brainstorm how you can make future protests even more smug and ineffective. Three, Obama and SpongeBob in 2008. Just think about it. That's all I'm saying. Four, push for shorter tours of duty for Iraq war protesters. Those poor people are out there without any protection. Five, phrase of the day, just drop it in a conversation. Reagan had Iran, Contra, Clinton had Monica Gate, Nixon had to resign. Enjoy your second term, a-hole. Wake up, sheeple. It's the beginning of the end.
So have a good trip up to Boston, y'all.
Okay.
Enjoy yourself.
Jimmy Tingle's off Broadway Theater in Somerville, Massachusetts, tonight and tomorrow.
All right. And Monday, we're going to find out what's going on. You know, they're going back to work on Capitol Hill. We'll find out the latest there. And Jeff Jarvis from BuzzMachine.com joins us as well. This is Air America Radio. Good weekend, everybody.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.